How to build a lean, profitable business that solves a problem in your industry. This is the Early Days Podcast. Hey everybody, welcome to the Early Days Podcast, the show about the hustle, the excitement, the doubts, the success, the failures, the ups and downs of building a business from scratch. My name is Marin Gerov, your host, and together with my co-founder Julian Summerjeef, we interview fellow entrepreneurs about their experience of building businesses. Why? Because we're actually doing that ourselves. We're building our own apparel company, it's called Duloware, and we make non-iron dress shirts from performance fabrics. There's a lot more benefits and properties, but you can go to our website, wearduloware.com, and check out more about that. Our guests on the show today are John and Alan from Ncrow, a software as a service solution for movie and TV end credits. If you're wondering what end credits are, those are the long lists of people who took part in a production that you see at the end of a movie or a TV show. In our conversation, we talk about how they solved a specific need and built a product around it, their initial validation and road to a minimum viable product, how they think about pricing models. We also cover how to deal with customer acquisition strategies and marketing to a wider audience. If you want to learn more, head over to ncrow.com. And now, without further ado, here is our conversation with John and Alan from Ncrow.
So Ncrow is a SaaS for making end credits. Actually, I should pause right there, Marin. Does your audience know what SaaS is? Is that a common term in Europe? I don't know.
Software as a service for those who don't know.
Yeah, so it's a software service. It's it runs in the browser and it's software. It's a system for making end credits for your film or your television show, your video game. It's just all those names that scroll by at the end of a film. Our software does that.
Yeah, because can you explain a little bit what kind of a need was the reason for you to create this?
Sure. So it's funny because I talk to friends who have software startups that do things that sound very technologically complex. And when you approach the question of, well, you're just making letters move from the bottom to the top of the screen, why is that difficult? And it's true. You can do this a lot of different ways. You can do it with traditional tools like Adobe. You can do it with plugins in editing software. But what you find is that they either look terrible, the typography is poor, the scrolling motion is very jittery. But the real problem is just managing hundreds or in some cases even thousands of names and roles. There's a lot that goes into that. There are political considerations. There's just a matter of constantly making another revision because you found a typo, because you misspelled someone's name, because you forgot someone in the special thanks. I used to run a post-production company, and I had to do this many, many times over the years. And
was
it's
that
just
mostly a manual process?
I'm sorry?
Was that mostly a manual process?
It always is. Yeah, before Ncrow, it's just a manual process. You lay it out either in Photoshop or Illustrator or maybe InDesign. Which are all very good tools, but they're not really meant to handle large amounts of data. And so what you'd end up with is your project would be this big glob of unstructured data. So if a customer or a client would call and say, hey, I want to see all the names in uppercase and bold, you'd say, sure, I'll get back to you tomorrow, or at least in hours from now. With our tool, everything is structured, so we know what a name is, what a role is, what a copyright notice is, what a song title is. And so if you want to make changes to the template, those are instant and they're very fast. And so that's one of the reasons that Ncrow is a lot easier to use than the traditional sort of workflow.
And when the other workflow, sorry for interrupting, do you have to collaborate with a lot of other people? Because looking at end credits at movies, usually there's like at least 10 companies working on a bigger film.
Yeah, so it usually falls to a small team of people. There's usually one person who will either be a producer or a post-production supervisor, or sometimes on an indie film, it'll be someone who's sort of wearing both hats. And then there will be perhaps some assistants who are working on the data entry as well and making sure that that's all up to that that's all current and correct. In addition, yes, they will typically, the people who are using Ncrow will make video outputs and then they need to distribute that to other stakeholders for approval. They might need to run it by legal. They might want to run it by different department heads from the production so that they can ensure that all of their crew were credited and that they are that everyone was included. So yeah, there is a big sort of collaboration aspect to it. And what Ncrawl mainly does is make that feedback loop really small and fast. Because when you make a render in Ncrawl, and a render means just a video output, and you can get a still image, you can get a video file all the way up to completely uncompressed mastering quality video. You click a button, it goes to our cloud render engine. If it's a preview video, you get it in 2 or 3 minutes. If it's the high quality 2K or 4K mastering quality, about a half hour. And that used to take hours or even, you know, a day or more to wait to get that next video render back. And so we've closed that and we made it unlimited for our customers, which makes it really easy for them to just keep working and revising those credits.
Great. And when did you decide to actually act on this and create the solution? When did you team up with Alan?
Alan, when was that?
I'm trying to think here. It was five and a half years ago.
Yeah, I mean, we incorporated in 2012, but we were talking about it before that, so we must have been. We must have been talking about that, I think, in the fall of 2011. Because what happened was I knew Alan. We were friendly. We had some mutual friends. We went out for burgers and beer. I ran the idea by him. Mostly, I just kind of wanted to ask him for advice on how to approach it technologically. I had it in my head that I was going to do it all myself back then, which was insane. And about 6 months later, he's like, "How's that thing going you told me about?" And I said, "I haven't done anything." And, one night we went to, it was sort of a holiday party for a post-production company. We went there, we had some drinks, got a little courageous. We talked ourselves into doing it. And that's when it really started. So that was about 6 years ago. We incorporated about 5.5 years ago.
How did you guys approach building it? Did you build it yourself, so outsourced it?
Alan?
Yeah, we built it ourselves. What built it meant in the beginning is not terribly impressive. We definitely followed the lean startup playbook. And so we tried to build as little as possible initially just to validate the idea. Essentially, Pliny, who he's modest about this, but he has some programming chops. He sat down at his breakfast table one day. He wrote a really crappy Perl script. Sorry, Pliny. And that was the basis for the initial version of Ncrawl.
You know, I need to go back and actually look at that code again because I haven't looked at it for years. I'm sure my skin will crawl.
Yeah, you were doing things where you'd change the code for every single project that came in, and that made my hair kind of stand on end. So, but it worked, and people were they were editing their credits in a Google Doc, and then they just asked Pliny to essentially run his program. Whenever they needed to render, and he was pretty quick about that. And he was using other tools to animate it and to lay it out and things like that. But people were paying for it. And I think, how many, did we do a dozen paying projects that way, Pliny?
Dozens, yeah. I think we did at least, I have on my desktop, and we did an interview on Indie Hackers, the site Indie Hackers, which is, I think, how we met and how we wound up on this podcast. And I think in the article, I included my desktop background, which is the first 24 Ncrawl projects ever. You can't read the text because it's too small, but I took the entire really, really long scroll and put all 24 of them side by side. So I know we did at least two dozen that very janky, hacky way. And then over time, Alan started to build out our back end.
How did you find those initial clients?
So we found them because of my connections. I had been running a post-production company for about 8 years. And that's where the need became apparent to me because I had to do it myself. I had to go through this very horrible, slow, broken process myself. And it was always frustrating. The customer, the client was unhappy. The vendor was unhappy. nobody enjoyed it. And so this was a case of me scratching my own itch.
That's fantastic. And it's actually very relatable to what we've been doing. And we also got an interview on Indie Hackers a while ago and kind of connected with this whole community. And it seems to be that most of the people there are people who are working from starting by solving their own problem and eventually building something that they put out in the world. And I remember your interview and I read it a lot. I really enjoyed it. I used to work in the entertainment industry as well. I found really fascinating how you're thinking about pricing. Maybe you can share about it.
Sure. Want me to take this one, Alan?
Yeah.
I mentioned a moment ago that we let customers make as many video renders as they like. What that means is that we have a flat pricing per project. So what happens in reality is that the actual customer, meaning the entity that cuts the check and pays for our service, is usually the LLC that's set up for the purpose of making one film. Every time there's an independent film or any type of film, at least in the United States, a separate business entity will be set up for that. It's almost always an LLC, which is a limited liability corporation. And so that's the company that is actually our customer. But our users are people who work in the film production gig economy. So they are editors, they are post-production supervisors, they are film producers, they are DI producers, they are colorists, they are directors. They sort of come from all over, although it concentrates in a few areas. And so they are the people who use it. And so it's sort of like a B2B, but we're selling to small businesses. And our relationships aren't with the businesses because each film is its own LLC and it comes and it goes. Our relationship is with the actual film producers and supervisors and editors and so forth who move from production to production to production within the gig economy. And so our selling efforts have to be about, you know, maintaining relationships with them. But coming back to the pricing, yeah, so we decided very early on we're going to charge per project, because every film production will have a budget line item for this already. And so it's not really controversial that someone needs to, you know, that end credits are needed or that they need to be paid for. That line item already exists. We're just sort of trying to scrape that line item and become the service that everyone uses. But the flat pricing is really important because a film production can have a long tail. Most indie films, when they're finished, don't have distribution. They will go, they'll try to hit the festival circuit. They'll try to get in front of buyers, eventually make a sale, eventually get some type of distribution. And that can take months. It can take a year or two. And when they do, they often have to come back and make some changes to the credits and put a few more names in. And so that part of the process has a very long tail. And one of the things people really disliked about the old way of making end credits was having to constantly make revisions. And eventually the designer or the title house would say, we have to charge you an overage. This is your 89th revision. And we never do. So once someone is paid up, then that film can make unlimited revisions and video outputs, very high quality video, as much as they want in perpetuity. And that's very different than what I think most people think of when they hear SaaS. In fact, we were having a conversation about that on Indie Hackers. And some people were claiming that the concept of software as a service necessarily implies a subscription model. And I disagree. I think a SaaS can have all types of pricing models. But the long and short of it is that the pricing model needs to align with your value proposition. And part of our core value proposition is, yes, end credit sucks. You're going to keep finding mistakes. You're going to keep finding typos, but you can keep just making revisions forever. And we're never going to penalize you for that. And that's a big part of our value prop.
And you have, I've noticed on your website, you have two tiers, I think. Can you explain the difference between the two and how did you decide to set them in stone, basically?
Sure. Well, nothing's set in stone. Pricing, you know, I think is an art form, and it's something we're still talking a lot about. Right now, we have two main tiers. We do have episodic pricing as well, but the two main tiers are called 2K and 4K. For those who don't work in film, that simply refers to the size of the video. Of course, you've probably heard 4K because 4K televisions are coming out now and becoming more of a thing. That just means that it's 4,096 pixels across, and 2K is half of that. And so we charge one price point for films that are finishing in 2K and a different price point for films finishing in 4K.
Great. So what are some of the challenges that you were having in the very beginning when you were starting? You mentioned you actually incorporated in 2012. I assume in the first couple of years, maybe working with your first clients, there were a lot of things that you had to learn on the go. Can you maybe share some of that?
Well, I think one of the things was, just the temptation to build a sort of a complete perfect product before we started showing it to people. So that was something that Pliny and I went back and forth on for a while before we just decided, you know, screw it. We're just gonna do this the lean way. You know, we're not gonna have like even a website or anything. We're just gonna essentially offer ourselves up as a semi-automated service and see what happens. Do you remember those days, Pliny? Like you had some pretty high-flying ideas about how this interface should look.
Yep. The conventional wisdom in entertainment is that perception is everything. And, you know, on launch day, everything has to be perfect. But that's because that's how films are made. You don't make a film the way you make software. You don't make half a movie and then put it out there and start iterating.
Maybe people should.
Well, that's a whole different thing. And I do have some thoughts on that. But the way films are made is very much the waterfall model. You know, it's all perfect once. You hide it under a bushel, you don't show anyone, and then, you know, you go and see it in the theater when it's perfect, when it's finished. I did bring some of that mentality with me, and Alan spent a long time talking me out of it. And I'm glad he did. It was successful because we launched something that, you know, I at times felt a little queasy about. I'm like, this doesn't look very polished. It doesn't have pizzazz. It, you know, it's this, it's that. It integrates with Google Docs. And it took me a long time to realize that nobody cares. They care about what's the core value proposition. They can keep making renders. They can make end credits easily. It saves them days of their lives. And that's the core value prop. We hit that. I should note that we do have a nice interface now, and it looks a lot better than it did 5 years ago. But I should have gotten over it a long time ago.
Well, this is hard stuff. I think almost every entrepreneur struggles with this. You know, you have this idea, you kind of fall in love with your idea, and you know, no one wants to have an ugly baby, right? No one wants to have someone say like, oh, hey, your baby's ugly, you know? And so you want to shield yourself from that possibility. And, you know, it's a natural thing, but gosh, I'm really glad that we got over it. And that book Lean Startup by Eric Ries, which I'm sure a lot of your audience is familiar with, was essential, I would say, to disabusing us of that it has to be perfect mindset.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. And is it only you two guys still working on it?
No, we actually, we have two product support specialists now. One on the East Coast US, one on the West Coast US. So we sort of like cover all the working business hours of the New York film industry and the LA film industry. So there's four of us total now.
How did you go about working together? I'm really curious because there's always a dynamic when you have two co-founders. Did you guys know it? You mentioned that you were friendly before, but have you ever worked together on a same project? How did you approach that when you started Endcrow?
Wow. Alan and I had not worked together. And so we kind of took a gamble. I think we took a We took a chance. I guess there was a little bit of founder dating there. We went to a few office parties. we talked about stuff. But it was still a bit of a roll of the dice, I think, when we decided to become business partners. And it did. I think we're very fortunate that it's worked out. I think the biggest challenge for us is, and not just the two of us working together, but our entire team, is that we are distributed. So like Alan mentioned, some of us are on the West Coast or Mountain Time, and some of us are in the East Coast. We don't have an office. We all just work remotely, and it's a real challenge to run a company that way. But I would like to encourage your listeners who might be in this a similar position. It's it's a challenge, but it's very much worth it because distributed cultures have a lot of things to commend themselves.
Can you take us through some of the benefits and the disadvantages that you've seen from your experience?
Of running a distributed team?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think one of the benefits that if you haven't worked in a distributed team before, you would probably tend to underrate is just the way that it encourages a written culture. I think being in person in an office with someone, there's a lot of decisions that are made and conversations that are had that happen verbally. And then there's no record of what decision was made and why. When you're a distributed team, you kind of can't rely on that anymore. And you're communicating in text, which is probably a little bit slower in some cases, but it leaves this permanent record. So, you know, if you're using Slack or something, everyone in the company later can go back and see like, oh, we decided this a year ago and here's why. And I think that benefit of just having a written culture is almost like an evolution forward from having this more informal, spoken verbal culture. It's kind of like, you know, a phase that civilization moved through or something. I feel like it is a paradigm shift that is almost that big. It really changes the way you do business.
Yeah, and if I can just tack on to that, you know, what Alan is describing necessarily means your company, your culture is more open, it's more transparent, and that just has a lot of effect. Downwind. So, I almost don't ever want to have a company that isn't designed this way again. I think even if we were all sitting in an office, I would want to implement a lot of the things that we do now. It's not just a record of decisions like Alan was describing, but we also have to just sort of document our own internal processes, even down to things like style guides and how do we talk to customers and, you know, what language do we use and things like that. But I think it really offers up just a lot of benefits and makes your company more open, and it encourages writing skills. It encourages people just to really be candid with each other.
And it's a great way also to help with onboarding when you start getting more people involved in the company as well.
Yep. Which we, you know, may have to do eventually.
How do you guys approach marketing and growing the company right now? The goal, of course.
It's, you know, I said this in the Indie Hackers interview. I think everyone, when they start a company, they have this idea that eventually we'll just sort of hit that inflection point and it'll be easy. It'll be automatic. And I forget the name of the founder now. Bear Metrics is another interview that was on Indie Hackers, but they have on their blog a great piece about that growth. And what you find is that often the opposite is the case. Instead of things going up like a hockey stick and increasing exponentially, things sort of level off. And I think often it's because if you're someone like me and you had some initial relationships in your field, in your industry that you're selling into, you might do a pretty good job at selling to those people you know. But at some point, the low-hanging fruit is gone. And that's when the real work of marketing begins. That's when you actually have to learn how to market to strangers and how to get out there and reach a wider audience. So the answer to your question is we're always doing a bunch of different marketing experiments. Right now, we're focusing more on one-on-one meetings, events. We're focusing on drip campaigns and outbound marketing. But we've tried just scores of things over the years. And the important thing, I think, is to pick something small, experiment with it. If it doesn't work, discard it, try something else. And the other thing we learned is that even when a marketing channel does work out, it might not work out forever. We read this other really good book called Traction. I forget the name of the author.
No, it's Gabriel Weinberg.
Gabriel Weinberg, thanks.
He's the DuckDuckGo founder.
Yeah, and one of the best insights I took away from that book is that a traction channel that is appropriate to one stage of your company's growth may not necessarily be one that's going to be appropriate to the next stage of your company's growth. And so, for example, we had some really great success early on Twitter. Twitter, a number of years ago, had a much stronger interest graph and the ability to build much better lookalike campaigns than Facebook did. But eventually that well sort of ran dry. And I think there were a couple reasons. One is that behavior on social media platforms changes over time. The other is that there aren't enough people on Twitter. And we sort of, saturated film Twitter at some point. And so you have to keep running experiments and you have to keep trying new things.
Yeah. And I you have to expect those experiments, most of them, to fail.
Yeah.
You have to be prepared for that because... most marketing channels, and there's a lot of different marketing channels. If you read Traction, you're going to, he's got 20 odd channels in there, and there's obviously more. Most of them just aren't going to work for your business, And so it's a process of finding the few that do work in the particular stage of growth that you're actually in. And so it can be a disheartening process, but if you go into it, you're sort of mining for gold, and eventually you're going to hit that channel. If you go into it with that mindset, I think it helps.
Yeah, I relate to that so much because we're currently at a very similar stage where we've basically exhausted the low-hanging fruit and then we're now trying almost different thing almost every day or at least every week.
That's good.
Yeah. I'd like to add one more thing to that, which is a lot of the advice that we hear about marketing and selling in the startup world comes from companies that are software developers selling to software developers, or maybe a little broader, technologists selling to technologists. Mm-hmm. And you have to take that advice with a grain of salt, especially if you're not selling to other software developers, because their attitudes and where they lurk online or offline might be very different. And one of the things we learned when we started doing customer interviews, a few years ago, we started sending out Christmas presents to our biggest customers every year, which was a great idea, by the way, not just because, we were showing the appreciation, but because whenever I do, it would open up whole new conversations or a customer I hadn't personally connected with in a while, only my support staff had been talking to. They started talking to me and they started telling me ideas about the product and offering up things that they otherwise wouldn't have. And so we started doing these one-on-one interviews with customers after they became paying customers. And one of the things we heard is that they really don't like advertising on Facebook. They personally just don't enjoy being advertised to on the platform. And they would never pick a professional filmmaking sort of post-finishing tool based on a Facebook ad, which makes a lot of sense once they said it to me. But we were still following that wisdom of, well, just advertise on Facebook. They have great targeting tools, and they do. You could say, just hit people in New York and LA with the following interests. But we just weren't getting anywhere on Facebook. And I was wondering, am I just making bad ads or what's going on? But what we heard talking to our customers is that they would never dream of picking a professional post-production tool from a Facebook ad. So we have to take that advice you hear with a grain of salt, especially if you're selling to a completely different market than, the Hacker News crowd.
No, exactly. That's very important. You should always know who you want to talk to and where those people are. And there's certainly a very big difference in behavior. That's what we've noticed as well. Now, I want to take the conversation a little bit to the future. Maybe do you want to share what's your future plans for the next 6 months or 1 year for EndCrawl?
Alan, I'm going to let you take that one.
Oh, boy. we have some specific things in mind. I think basically the plan is to grow. So we're kind of growing currently at just an organic pace that's pretty good. But we're looking for the gas pedal, And if we can find the gas pedal, if we can find, a few channels that are, the right channels for us at this particular stage, then we're going to push on the gas pedal and grow faster. I think that's a goal. And then we also have some goals around just the product, adding things here and there that sort of broaden and deepen the offering to certain customer segments. You know, some of these customer segments are people that are they're deep in the industry. They're making high budget films. They've been in the industry forever. They expect certain sort of pro features. And then some of the things we're adding are just so that we can go down market. So we're kind of trying to expand, you know, that area under the curve that we can actually reach. We're still automating things in this company. You know, that's a big ongoing thing. You know, we still don't have a complete product. There's still things that our product specialists have to do for people through our support system. And that's, you know, that's fine, but you know, we definitely need to automate some more of those things so that we can take on more work.
Yeah, I that's a really important point, and it's something that, again, it took me too long to get comfortable with. I would say right now Ncrawl is like 80% automated and 20% our support team helps out projects to customize things that you can't do through the interface. Or maybe it's more 90-10, but there is sort of that type of ratio there. And we started working with another company, a vendor this year, fulfilling all our swag, our t-shirts and things like that. And they're similar. And when I saw how they worked, I actually was really encouraged that they were in a similar sort of place where, yeah, we'll build the tools to do all the obvious things. But then there are all sorts of other little customizations that it wouldn't make sense to build out elaborate features, because we're not trying to recreate Photoshop here. We're not trying to recreate an Adobe product. And our customers, many of them are non-technical. They're film producers, but they're not technologists. And so we don't want to overwhelm them with a tool that looks like they have to be a professional designer to use it. So it's been a real challenge, but a really satisfying challenge to figure out what features we need to build and which ones we don't. If we hadn't done the lean thing, we would have spent a lot of time chasing down my incorrect assumptions on the types of features that customers wanted. But because we started lean and iterated, we learned what things customers ask for constantly and which ones they don't actually care about. And I would have been wrong about a number of them.
Okay, well, that's fantastic insight from your experience as well. Where can people go and find out more about Ncrawl? And perhaps you two can share your personal handles on Twitter or Indie Hackers, where people can get in touch with you and maybe ask you for some questions.
Sure. Ncrawl is at ncrawl.com. That's ncrawl.com. You can sign up there. And my handle is IamPliny. That's IamPliny on Twitter.
And my handle on Twitter is Alan Grow. That's ALANGROW.
Perfect. Well, Alan Pliny, thank you so much for being on the show.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. If you enjoyed it and found it valuable, we would really appreciate your support by liking, rating, subscribing to the Early Days podcast. This program is produced and hosted by Dulo, that's me and Julian. And as we mentioned in the very beginning, we make non-iron dress sheets from performance fabrics. If you want to learn more, head over to weardulo.com, that's weardulo.com, and take a look at our products, our story, and the journey of how we're building the business. Until next time, bye-bye.